American Bankster. Let me know if the volume is not good or at any time. Rob says no audio on his end. Probably Rob's problem since other people are saying everything's good. Okay, if you hear buzzing, it might be the fan on my laptop, unfortunately. Okay. It's buzzing, yeah. Jeff says all good. Okay, we'll get started then. And the final thing we'll do tonight, I guess, is talk. I wanted to talk about the current situation with the banksterism. And it begins, I guess the story would begin with the busting of the dot-com bubble around 2000, the year 2000. And this was yet another bubble created by the Greenspan Fed. And at that time, it happened to be in the so-called dot-com companies. And some of you might remember that in the late 90s, on American television, all that was there on the advertisements was companies with a name and then dot-com at the end of it. And many of these companies were not even capitalized. They didn't have customers. They were business plans or ideas that had convinced investors to give them gobs of money based on an idea because everyone wanted to get in on e-commerce. And the Fed fueled that by making it very easy for businesses to borrow money and become capitalized with low interest rates. And so it created a bubble there, and the bubble burst. And then after the bursting of that bubble, of course, the Fed does what the Fed does, and it went right to work trying to create a new bubble with even more money put into circulation and lower interest rates. And I had on my door for the past year, my office door, a picture of Paul Krugman and a statement of his from the New York Times in the around 2001 saying, what the Fed should do in response to the bursting of the dot-com bubble is create a bubble in real estate. And so the Fed apparently took his advice and did do that. And the rest is history, as they say. And so, I put on the syllabus for tonight this very short little article by Mark Thornton explaining the main problem. The main problem was when the Fed pushes down interest rates, it really is an act of price control. And, you know, economists are almost universally opposed to price controls, but for some reason they don't recognize, and most of them don't seem to recognize, that when the Fed tries to manipulate interest rates, that's a price control. And it's bound to create distortions just like any other distortions are created by price controls on corn or wheat or gasoline or anything else. And so, but in banking, what happens when the Fed artificially pushes down the rate of interest, then all of a sudden, a lot of people who were not creditworthy become creditworthy in the eyes of banks because they've got all these excess reserves now. They have additional borrowing ability that the Fed has put into their laps. And who are they going to lend the money to? Well, it might be people who were turned down last year, but now these marginally creditworthy people are good borrowers now. And it's because they've got more reserves, more to borrow, and the reserves are not doing the banks any good, they're just sitting there. And so the lowering of interest rates by the Fed encourages banks to take on more subprime borrowers. And so that went on in a very big way, and the government government policy led to over $1 trillion in loans like this that really were very, very marginal. But that wasn't the only part of it. Another part of it has to do with the government policy changes beginning in the early 90s that encouraged or extorted, forced, coerced banks and other mortgage lenders to make bad loans to unqualified borrowers. And this all started with the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977. And what the Community Reinvestment Act did was supposedly to force banks to make more loans in minority neighborhoods because the argument was that racism was causing them to make fewer loans in minority neighborhoods than in other neighborhoods. And so the government, the Fed, monitors this. The Office of Thrift Supervision monitors this. The Comptroller of the Currency regulates the Community Reinvestment Act. And there are very big penalties and fines involved in non-compliance with the Community Reinvestment Act. And so this has been around since the 70s, the late 70s. And economists have always disputed the need for this because it just doesn't make sense that you would have creditworthy borrowers who millions of dollars in profits just sitting there in minority neighborhoods, and no banks, not even minority-owned banks, the theory goes, would lend them money. So they were even arguing that minority-owned banks are discriminating against fellow minorities and not lending enough money. Of course, the reason why the lending was not taking place is that these people, a larger proportion of people in these so-called minority neighborhoods in the U.S. were uncreditworthy than in other neighborhoods. And it wasn't race per se, it was economic creditworthiness that was the issue or the problem. In fact, when Peter Brimelow and Leslie Spencer, two journalists at the time writing for Forbes magazine, confronted a Fed bureaucrat, Alicia Monell, and asked her about some report that she had just published under the auspices of the Fed about lending discrimination, they asked her, well, what is the evidence of lending discrimination? And she came right out and said, I don't have any evidence. And that was about 20 years ago. I think it was around somewhere around 1992 in Forbes magazine. And she admitted she had no evidence. But then in the early 90s, 92 and 94, during the Clinton administration especially, this law was strengthened. And so what this law does basically, one of the things it does, is it empowers so-called community groups like ACORN. ACORN is an acronym for Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, ACORN. This is who Barack Obama went to work for as soon as he got his Harvard Law degree, ACORN. He was a lawyer and a community organizer for ACORN. And ACORN and many other groups around the country were formed and funded by the government in the 60s and 70s. And James Bennett and I wrote a whole book about this in 1985. It was called Destroying Democracy, How Government Funds Partisan Politics. And that's ancient history by now. But anyway, the way the law works is if any bank wants to propose a bank expansion, opening up a new branch, or merging with another bank, ACORN and these other community organizations and issue a protest with the Fed claiming that they have not lent enough money to minority neighborhoods. And it can hold up the bank expansion, it can hold up the building of a new branch, it can hold up a merger with another bank, and this can cost the bank many millions of dollars. And so what happens is the money is given to ACORN, and ACORN gets into the lending business. And of course, the banks are forced to make bad loans also to uncreditworthy borrowers in order to satisfy ACORN. There was one community activist in Boston that I quoted in one of my articles years ago. His name was Bruce Marx, M-A-R-K-S, pronounced like Karl Marx. And he bragged that in Boston, he ran something called the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. He boasted to the New York Times that he had, quote, won commitments, end quote, from banks under the Community Reinvestment Act, totaling $3.8 billion with a B. That's just in Boston. And so this was sort of strong-arming commercial banks into making $3.8 billion in bad loans, essentially subprime loans. And so this law was strengthened to empower groups like this guy, Bruce Marx, and ACORN even more in the mid-90s. And a sort of a smoking gun, as I see it, in this whole episode was a very influential Boston Fed study that was very widely distributed by the Fed, and the policy recommendations made by it were touted by the Fed everywhere. And it claimed that there is a lending gap In fact, the title of the publication is Closing the Gap, A Guide to Equal Opportunity Lending. And it bemoaned the fact that there is a gap between people who can afford a mortgage, and B, people who cannot afford a mortgage. And so this gap has to be closed. And of course, the same can be said for a Mercedes-Benz gap, a second vacation home gap, a ski vacation in Aspen gap, a private school for your kids gap. Some people can afford these things and some cannot. So this gap needs to be closed. That's a perfect statement of socialism, isn't it? The equalization of incomes is the ultimate objective here, or outcomes, as far as that's concerned, as far as housing is concerned, and not necessarily opportunity. And so this Boston Fed study reminded banks that failure to comply with this law results in liability for punitive damages as much as $10,000 per individual action, and the lesser of $500,000 or 1% of the creditor's net worth. And so they're threatening banks with huge fines for non-compliance. And it announced that the normal lending standards for lenders is not acceptable anymore when it comes to minority and low-income borrowers. And so they said that such things as proof of income are discriminatory against these groups. And so there, and it said that banks should adopt special standards of lending that are different than the traditional standards of lending. For example, credit history should be abandoned. They said proof of income, don't need it. And the tax returns, forget it. That's where no-doc loans came from, no-documentation loans. If you're a minority or a low-income borrower, no documents necessary. And so other agencies of government, including HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, also promoted the lending. They had a goal of 80% of Americans owning their own homes. And also the government got the U.S. Treasury to put up billions of dollars to create these so-called community banks that would do the same, that would make more bad loans to unqualified borrowers. And at the same time, while all of these bad loans are being made, the banks, of course, you might ask yourself, well, why would the banks go along with this? Why would the banksters, why wouldn't they organize a lobby to oppose this? Because why would they want to make bad loans? Well, they had it all figured out all along, because what happened was the banks would make the bad loan and get a fee, you know, whatever the fee is, $700, $1,000, $3,000, whatever the fee is for making the loan, they would pocket the fee. And then the government, the U.S. Congress, ordered Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to buy up, to use its resources to buy up trillions of dollars of these bad loans and to securitize them, to bundle them up into securities and sell them as bonds. Today they're known as toxic assets. And so the banks, if you look at the banksters, they made a fee for each one of these bad loans, and then they made a second fee by selling the loan to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac at the insistence of U.S. Congress. And Ben Bernanke himself, the chairman of the Fed, bragged about the great success of all this. And he made a speech on March 30th, 2007, commemorating the 30th anniversary of the Community Reinvestment Act. It's a speech, you can probably find a speech on the web. It's entitled The Community Reinvestment Act, Its Evolution and New Challenges. And here's what he said. He's phrasing the, quote, securitization of affordable housing loans that expanded, as did the secondary market for these loans, in part reflecting a 1992 law that required the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to devote a large percentage of their activities to meeting affordable housing goals. So here's Ben Bernanke in 2007, right before the crash, bragging in a public speech about how compliant Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were in the orders given to them by Congress to buy up and securitize trillions of dollars of bad loans. He also referred to the 1994 Regal Neal Interstate Banking and Branching Efficiency Act. Whenever the Congress passes a law called an Efficiency Act, you know it's going to create grotesque inefficiency in whatever market it is applied to. And what this did was to loosen up the regulatory barriers to bank mergers. And by loosening up the regulatory barriers to bank mergers, it empowered groups like Acorn even more because they challenged bank mergers. And Bernanke recognized this. He said this, advocacy groups increasingly use the public comment process to protest bank applications on CRA grounds. He's bragging about this. So there was, in other words, an explosion of this type of what I think of as legalized extortion activity by groups like Acorn. And not surprisingly, Bernanke says, quote, banks began to devote more resources to their CRA programs, end quote. No kidding. And so by 2008, one of these banks, Countrywide Bank, was given a special award by the Fed for having made $600 billion in subprime loans. And then not too long after that, Countrywide went bankrupt. And this, of course, is part of the main reasons why the bailouts applied massively to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and why when they did pass a new law, Congress passed a new law, the Dodd-Frank law, to impose reams and reams of regulation on the banking industry after all the bailouts, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were exempt. They were not mentioned at all in these laws. And so the banksters had themselves all covered with the CRA. They made money on both ends. They made money making the bad loans. Not a huge amount, but they made a fee, and then they sold the bad loans to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac securitized these loans, and all the government establishment guaranteed investors that these were good assets, that these were good sound loans. But of course, some of the smarter investors understood that these were garbage and they were toxic from the very beginning, and stayed totally away from them. And so, of course, the crash happened because bubbles always burst. And so the point I'm making is that the Fed is the main culprit here in its pursuit of negative real interest rates after inflation and historically low mortgage rates, but also the other agencies of government, HUD, the Community Reinvestment Act, the Fed itself as the enforcer of the Community Reinvestment Act, also contributed to making trillions of dollars in bad loans that people could not pay off once the bubble burst and the economy tanked. And then, of course, the banksters made out very well with the bailouts. The first thing the government did was to take care of the banksters with the massive bailouts, which is why I put a couple of these sort of snide-sounding articles by Bob Higgs on the reading list. And I just can't help but quoting one of them, the one on the TARP is dead, long live the TARP, commenting on what Hank Paulson did, the Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson, who was the chairman of Goldman Sachs. He leaves Goldman Sachs, the Bush administration appoints him Treasury Secretary, and here's how he describes it. Congress gave Hank Paulson $700 billion to bail out losing banks. The first thing he did was to take $125 billion out of the bag and give it to his pals at the 9 biggest banks and investment banks in the country. Never one to display ingratitude, he gave $10 billion to Goldman Sachs, the firm he had headed before passing through the revolving door to the Treasury. So think about that. He leaves Goldman Sachs, goes into the government, literally robs the U.S. Treasury, and gives his company $10 billion. And then I personally recall reading in the New York Times shortly after he did this that in the style section or whatever their version of the style section is, that his wife was out shopping and bought herself a new $5 million house in the Hamptons, one of many that they own in the Hamptons. And after he gave his company $10 billion in taxpayers' money. And so And so Higgs writes about what is happening here is a massive, massive redistribution of income and wealth from the prudent and the responsible to the imprudent and irresponsible. All the people who paid their mortgages on time, paid their bills, went to work, saved their money, they're screwed. Their taxes are raised. Inflation is going to be created by the printing of all the money. There'll be more boom and bust. There's no way of making any money in savings anymore. They're screwed. But the banksters are bailed out to the tune of many trillions of dollars, and they were immediately. And of course, there was the way the government got away with this was this giant chorus of scare tactics, claiming that the entire banking system of the world will collapse and go to hell if we don't bail out these bad businesses. It's even worse than that. In return for the bailouts, the government demanded shares of preferred stock in these banks. And so this was a de facto nationalization of the capital markets. There's no bigger way to create socialism in a country than government control of capital markets. And so this is exactly what happened. That's why the Obama administration was so enthusiastic about continuing the Bush bailouts, that they understood this was a way of creating socialism, finally, and to realizing Eugene Debs' dream of bringing socialism to America. It was the Bush administration, and then followed up by the Obama administration, that is finally doing it by socializing the capital markets. Okay. And so there was this chorus of scare tactics beginning during the Bush administration, and then also the usual characters in academia and the media and all around the world also started telling the big lie that all of it was created by laissez-faire and free markets. That's the problem. For example, let me give you one of many examples, but there's one example. There was the business historian named John Steele Gordon who wrote in the Wall Street Journal that the cause of the crash was, quote, the baleful influence of Thomas Jefferson and his anti-central banking views. Wall Street stockbroker Henry Kaufman wrote in the Financial Times that libertarian dogma had led the Fed astray. And, okay, since Alan Greenspan was a young protege of Ayn Rand, he said that the Fed somehow is a libertarian laissez-faire institution. But all you have to do to find out what a bunch of bunk that is look up a publication on the Fed entitled The Federal Reserve System, Purposes and Functions. It's a Fed publication. And among the functions, it lists dozens and dozens of regulatory functions of the Fed. And it does more than monetary policy. It does more than increase and decrease the money supply. I'll read part of a list of functions of the Fed in terms of what it regulates and what it did regulate under Greenspan. Bank holding companies, state chartered banks, foreign branches of member banks, hedge and agreement corporations, U.S. state-licensed branches, national banks, savings banks, non-bank subsidiaries of bank holding companies, thrift holding companies, financial reporting procedures of banks, accounting policies of banks, business continuity policy, consumer protection laws, securities dealings of banks, information technology used by banks, controlled by the Fed, foreign investment by banks, regulated by the Fed, foreign lending by banks, regulated by the Fed. Fed regulates branch banking, branch mergers and acquisitions. Who may own a bank is regulated by the Fed. Capital adequacy standards are regulated. Extension of credit for the purchase of securities regulated by the Fed. Equal opportunity lending. Mortgage disclosure information. Reserve requirements. And just fair credit reporting. Truth in lending. Truth in saving. Transactions between member banks and their affiliates, and on and on and on. There are hundreds more in this publication, functions of the free market Fed. But this line was repeated over and over and over again. Here's some more. There's the New York Times. The mortgage crisis is laissez-faire gone wrong. Laissez-faire. The president of France said laissez-faire economics, self-regulation, and the view that the all-powerful market always knows best are finished now. Paulson brings laissez-faire approach on the financial crisis, the New York Times said. So the bailouts under Paulson were supposedly a laissez-faire approach to the financial crisis. And so you had people like this all over the world, the usual suspects, the socialists in the media and in academia, proclaiming that this crisis created by the Fed and by other government institutions is somehow magically the work of the free market. And it simply wasn't. And you know, one of the hallmarks of capitalism is a profit and loss system. And that goes for the banking system as well as any other industry. And so if you have a system whereby the profits are private and the losses are socialized, well, you've got economic fascism. That's not capitalism. It's a destruction of capitalism. And that is exactly what has happened, not over only in the U.S., but all over the world with the bailouts. And so there was a giant propaganda campaign that was very successful with the bailouts of the banks. And so once again, the banksters prevailed. And they're not shy at all about going along and sitting quietly with all of this. In fact, I can recall right after the crash happened, there was the Fed had sent economists around to offer to give lectures at universities, and several of them from the Richmond Fed gave a lecture at my university in Baltimore, Loyola University, and the topic of the lecture was how hard it was for low-income families to cope with the fact that they had lost their homes through bank through a foreclosure. And so I wrote an email to the dean at the time who sponsored the lecture saying, listening to Fed bureaucrats bemoan the effects of foreclosures is like listening to pyromaniacs bemoan the effects of house fires. And the dean didn't like it, but I could care less about that, but that's exactly what the Fed did. They were sending people out to say, oh, these poor people, their homes have been foreclosed, when of course they caused the crisis, the foreclosure crisis themselves with Fed policy. And so they need to be called out about that a lot more than they are. And I hope you have a time to read the article I put on the mail on the reading list, if you haven't already, by George Reisner, entitled The Myth That Laissez-Faire is Responsible for Our Present Crisis. And he mentions some of these wacky statements about describing the U.S. economy as somehow a free market economy. But just look at some of the facts he points out very quickly. Government spending in the U.S. is more than 40% of national income. So the U.S. economy is more than 40% socialized already. There are presently 15 federal cabinets, 9 of which exist for the purpose of interfering with housing, transportation, healthcare, education, energy, mining, agriculture, labor, and commerce. And also the Federal Register in the United States, which is a listing of federal government regulations that are used to enforce federal laws. At the time George Reisner wrote this article, says at the end of 2007, the Federal Register contained 73,000 pages of small print of government regulation, 73,000 pages. And that's what the New York Times and other people call laissez-faire, unregulated economy. And so I think it's incumbent on anybody who studies and writes about these things to call these people out on it as the liars that they are whenever they use this kind of language, because they know better. Surely the New York Times, which has championed all these regulations all these years, knows that they exist and that we don't live in some sort of laissez-faire fairyland. But apparently the political game, is to assume that there are enough millions of people out there who really are rationally ignorant and who will fall for this and who will vote and support whatever they want to do under the misbelief that we live in some sort of laissez-faire society, and that is the cause of all our problems. Okay, and so I think that's pretty much what I wanted to say about banksterism in today's world, because I thought that one, a lot of you are probably not too familiar with this racket of the Community Reinvestment Act, and I do think it wasn't the main cause of the crash. The Fed was the main cause, but it helped. It helped a lot. And it wasn't only the banks that were regulated under the Community Reinvestment Act, because once they were making all these loans and then selling the loans to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, in order to compete, other banks and other mortgage lenders who had to compete also had to start making these subprime loans by the trillions at the same time. So it wasn't just the banks that are regulated by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and or the Fed and the Community Reinvestment Act. It was thousands of other banks and mortgage lenders who were sort of forced into it by the government, because if not, they might not have existed. They might have gone bankrupt if they didn't play this game. And, of course, many of these loans were also scooped up by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which themselves were bailed out with over $1 trillion in bailout funds. And again, you know, it's the middle class that paid for all this, because that's where most of the money is. They pay for it through taxes. Inflation will come. We'll get price inflation. And that'll reduce the value of privately held wealth. And also, all the extra borrowing by the federal government to pay for all this, for all these bailouts, crowds out private borrowing for homes and businesses and anything else that private individuals and businesses and families would borrow money for. And so those three ways are ways in which the average person is all paying for banksterism and essentially bank socialism in America. And so I guess I'll wrap it up there. That's about all I had to say for tonight. And we'll do... what we usually do, I'll be glad to try to answer whatever questions you have. I see Cam is doing his usual great job with all the links. I found this publication, Closing the Gap. If you're really interested in this topic, read that publication. It's eye-poppingly bad, and it comes right out and says, make bad loans, don't ask people what their income is, don't ask them for a W-2 form. Don't ask them for a credit report, and if you do, you may face penalties. You may face tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars in penalties. Yeah, Michael is asking, you know, the so-called mortgage-backed securities. Those are the toxic assets. And that's another thing the Fed did. I mean, the Fed now bought up trillions of dollars of these toxic assets. So the Fed printed money out of thin air to buy up paper that is even more worthless, the so-called toxic assets. So the Fed owns all these now, all these bad loans. And what is it going to do with them? No one will want to buy them. It's just going to sit on them and make us all pay eventually. Well, the derivatives, you know, all these derivatives, this was just a way in which the banks made the most of the situation the Fed created for them, all the so-called derivatives. Let me see if there's any Q&A. Helen is asking, does the Fed create false studies in order to have an official reason to pump money into the economy? You don't necessarily need to call them false studies. But there's an economist at the University of Georgia, used to be at Georgia, I kind of lost track of him now. His name's Larry White. I think he's left. He went to the University of Missouri for a while, and I'm not sure where he is. Maybe he's at George Mason now. I haven't seen him in years. But he published an article in one of the big monetary journals, I think it was the Journal of Monetary Economics, a few years ago, in which he found that something like 3/4 of all academic economists who write on monetary issues have been paid by the Fed one way or another, a research contract, consulting contract, summer internship, something like that, or directly employed by the Fed. And so they do tend to write articles that support Fed policy, and if nothing else, they are not critical. They don't ask the critical questions, because you don't get your research grant next year if you're too critical of the Fed and what you say about it this year. It's okay to make constructive criticisms about what the Fed should be doing that it is not doing, but you don't call the Fed out for forcing banks to make trillions of dollars in bad loans and things like that. That's not acceptable. And so I don't know if I'd call them false studies, but misleading to be sure. I think I read off last week, I think it was, I read from some of the textbooks, Paul Samuelson's textbooks and other textbooks, the misleading rhetoric about how the Fed acts selflessly to promote the public interest and that sort of thing. And that is, it's not false, but it's misleading. You can't prove it false in a court of law, but it would be misleading to be sure. Let's see, Helen also wants to know if guys like Paulson are viewed as heroes by the Fed. I'm sure they're viewed as heroes by the banksters who were given billions of dollars by Paulson. But I can't answer that. I don't know how the Fed, how Ben Bernanke would view him. We'll have to ask Ben Bernanke. Helen, yeah, I think these people are delusional. I mean, how could they have not foreseen the housing bubble? It was the Austrians were talking about it, the Austrian economists in 02 and 03. Ron Paul was on record in 2002 saying we're creating a housing bubble. He was on television saying that. And also, a lot of the investment firms had data that they would send out in their investment newsletters showing that housing prices in the United States were about 20% above trend by the time you get to 2004, 2005. And so, that's a bubble. And so they had to know about this, and they kept doing it anyway. And they even had academic supporters like Paul Krugman claiming the business cycle has ended, prosperity is going to last forever. Keynesian central planning has prevailed, the Fed has prevailed. There were books written about Greenspan calling him the maestro, as though he's a grand conductor of the world economy. They were sort of drunk with power, and they certainly didn't foresee the housing bubble. You can go online, go on YouTube, and search around, typing in Ben Bernanke and the housing bubble. And there are all kinds of statements of him mocking the fact that people think there's a housing bubble in 2007. Or also go and type in Peter Schiff was right. There are several videos there of Peter Schiff was right. Of Peter Schiff informed by the Austrian school theory of the business cycle in 05, 06, 07, saying, look out, the bubble's going to burst, something really bad is going to happen. And all these other pro-Fed economists just laughing their heads off and ridiculing Peter Schiff, mocking him, snickering, and he was right and they were all wrong. So the Fed heads are not rationally ignorant. Helen is asking about that, but I think they do know that millions of ordinary citizens are rationally ignorant of the mysterious activities of the Fed. Who knows what the Fed does? Not even economists are fully aware of what the Fed is up to, because as you probably know, Ron Paul failed to get an audit of the Fed through Congress. But they do know what they're doing. It's a cozy cabal. Rob Mack is asking this question. He said a friend of his who used to work on Wall Street said those at the highest levels of government and Wall Street are criminals and know what they're doing. They pass laws that exempt themselves from criminal prosecution. So what they're doing is criminal, but it's not necessarily against the law. You could call it criminal. The game is that they enrich the Wall Street banksters, and the Wall Street banksters in turn finance their political careers, give them big jobs when they retire, give big jobs to their spouses and children. You know, why is it that, you know, Chelsea Clinton marries a New York investment bank? You know, very incestuous. That's the way it sort of works. And so so the government, it's economic fascism. That's what economic fascism is, a collaboration between big business and big government. And they know exactly what they're doing. If I can get back to, oh good, Cam got the Peter Schiff was right video, that's good. Okay, Michael wants to know if I think there's a relationship between the Arab Spring and the central bank's creation of inflation. I think there probably was, because I remember the food prices were rising dramatically in countries like Egypt. And so the inflation by the central bank, I think, did have something to do with that. And that led to riots in the Middle East. Let's see, Travis wants to know if free banking would solve the problems of the business cycle, essentially. Well, it's all relative. You know, even when we did not have a central bank, we still had all types of government interference in banking. And so it all depends on how you, what you mean by free banking. You could think of an imaginary world where there's a laissez-faire in banking and competing currencies. But the real history of the United States, anyway, is that even in periods when we did not have a central bank, such as between 1842 and 1913, there was no national bank, but there was a lot of government regulation of banking and money. The National Currency Act, Legal Tender Act, or branch banking regulation, the Congress would suspend specie payments periodically, quite often to help finance wars. And so it depends on what you mean by so-called free banking. Joe was asking, what would cause the world to stop accepting dollars as the reserve currency? Well, when people lose faith, you know, in history, when a currency becomes so devalued by inflation, that people just spontaneously decide to not use it. And no one can predict when that would happen. I mentioned a while ago, I had at the Austrian Economic Research Conference a few weeks ago, I had a little talk with a Bulgarian economist who works for the EU now, Nikolai, his name, and he was marveling how so many Europeans don't understand that the type of things that happened in Bulgaria, where the whole society sort of collapsed within a week, and he thinks this could happen again in some of the European countries with their welfare states imploding and their banking systems falling apart right now as we speak, but no one could predict when something like that would happen. And so, you know, what would cause the world to stop accepting dollars? Well, certainly if inflation finally really kicks in and the banks start stepping up lending, and it was they could any day now, and creating some serious price inflation, that'll do it. Sure, gold can complete a dollar, or currency, competing currencies based on gold and silver could replace the dollar, Helen is asking. And so hopefully that's what would happen. Remy is asking about the first National Bank of the U.S. and its delegated powers. I'm not sure what that question means. The first bank in the United States, you know, we talked about this, you know, in the 1790s, that bank, the BUS, Bank of the United States, it was not in the Constitution. There's no delegated power of Congress to create such a thing. And so I'm not exactly sure what Rami is getting at. Rob is asking, do Austrian economists mostly agree with Rothbard about the inherent fraudulence of fractional reserve? No, there are different schools. The people like Professor George Selgin and Larry White, who I mentioned, I don't think they agree with that. Certainly most Austrian economists who are associated with the Mises Institute, if you went to the Austrian Economic Research Conference in Auburn a couple of weeks ago, there were, 160, 180 people there. I'm pretty sure most of them would agree with Rothbard, but not all of them. But it's a hard thing to understand why they wouldn't, in light of looking at the events of the past 7 or 8 years with the bailouts and the pandering, the slavish pandering to the Wall Street banks by the Fed and the Treasury. How could you not think this is corrupt? Rob wants to know how long this can last. Well, I, of course, don't know that, but I do think we are witnessing the crumbling of fractional reserve banking systems all over the world, including the United States, with all these bailouts. Joe Salerno has written a few blogs about this, and the Circle Bastiat blog on Mises.org, and maybe if you can search around there, you can find some of the things that Joe Salerno has written about this and his opinion that this is what we're observing, is the final crack-up of the fractional reserve system. But of course, no one knows how long it can last, because if nothing else, the whole system is so secretive. We don't know. We've never audited the Fed. We don't even know if there's any gold in Fort Knox anymore in the United States. They claim it's all there, but who knows? Noel is asking about, the Fed bought all these bad loans. The Fed bought these bad loans from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, toxic assets. Were the people who were lent the money still responsible? A lot of people just walked away. They just walked away, and there are different laws regarding that in different states in the U.S. If you walk away, it'll ruin your credit rating for 7 years, and you still may have to owe money to the bank. The bank will take the house and sell it, and if it sells it at a lower price than what the loan is, then you may or may not be on the hook for the loan. But Doug French has written a monograph and several articles about advocating that people walk away from the mortgage loans. And basically, part of his argument was that, well, now the banks were bailed out. The banks were bailed out for their bad decisions. Why is it also fair for ordinary people to pretty much walk away and get their bailout, de facto bailout, if they're underwater, so to speak, if they owe more than what the house is worth? It's only fair, is sort of part of Doug French's article. And so you could probably find these articles on Mises.org. He wrote quite a few of them. And they were put into a small monograph by the Mises Institute, I think maybe about 2 years ago. I don't give, there's a question from Bob about buying gold. I don't like to give anybody investment advice. I'm a little skeptical about it. I think I'm not convinced it's going to keep going up like some other people are, like Peter Schiff, for example. There's so much uncertainty about how much gold is owned by the Fed or other governments and what they could do with it if they want to start dumping it on the market and depress the price. And so that creates, I'm a conservative investor, and so I'm sitting on the sidelines on that. Since it was brought up to $1,600 an ounce, and it's currently a little over $1,550 or something like that, I don't think it's a buyer's market anymore. That's my opinion. I had too many things pop up in the past week. I wasn't able to get through Stockman's book. I was hoping to talk about it tonight, but I had too much going on with school and my classes and all that. So maybe some other time. Let's see. Yes, shares of Bitcoin tumbled today. Joe was mentioning this. Robert wants to know if there's any country that doesn't inflate its currency. Well, it's all relative. How much do you inflate your currency? Once you have a fractional reserve banking system and a central bank, that's the whole purpose of it, is to inflate the currency. And so, of course, everybody inflates currency. It's a matter of how much is the question. Zimbabwe is probably the worst on the planet, whereas other countries are not so bad in inflating their currency. And one way to get a comparison would be to look up these indexes of economic freedom that are published by the Wall Street Journal and by the Fraser Institute, and because they have sections or whole chapters on monetary freedom. And they rank countries according to the extent to which they have inflated their currency and created inflation and economic instability by doing that. And so if you really want to follow up on that, that's one place I would look. And the Fraser Institute, F-R-A-S-E-R, and the Wall Street Journal and Heritage Foundation co-publish an index of economic freedom also. Phil is asking about exams. I'm going to make up one in the next day or two and send it to Danny Sanchez. And so it'll be available on the web for anybody who wants to take another exam and get a final grade. And so you'll get your nice certificate of completion online from the Mises Institute. And if you want it with a grade, I'll put a grade on it. And so I'll get that done in the next day or two. I assume the answers are available. I sent Danny the answers for the first one. Questions about Bitcoins. I'm not a Bitcoin expert, and so I really can't answer the viability of Bitcoins as a currency. Helen wants to know if silver could be more useful than gold. Well, all I can say is historically, gold has won out. Historically, gold and silver have been pretty reliable, but more people relied on gold and trusted gold and silver over literally thousands of years in human history. Now Rob is asking about Antal Fakite and a new Austrian school of economics. No, I've never heard of it. Well, I have a comment on Japan. In race to the bottom currency. I guess you're referring to the fact that Japan has famously been in a recession for, 25 years now, 20 years, and because they keep reading Paul Krugman's columns and taking his advice, basically. They've done everything that Paul Krugman could dream of doing. Bigger and bigger deficits, printing more and more money, government expansionism, raising taxes, and of course that is why they've been in a recession for 20 years, more or less. Well, sure, Audrey, not a course of the gold standard, but sure, that's what needs to happen, is money based on gold, on a gold standard. And let's see if I can, it's not the kind of question you can answer, make the case for the gold standard in a soundbite or a Q&A session, but there's a lot on Mises.org to explain the gold standard, Tom Woods had a very nice lecture on objections to the gold standard and answering objections to the gold standard. If you look through the media section on the Mises.org list, you'll probably, and look under Tom Woods' entries, you'll probably find his presentation on the gold standard. And Tom is a very, very clear thinker and speaker. And so if you want to get a sort of good introductory lesson on that, look at that. And also Mark Thornton did the same thing. Look under the media section of Mises.org and scroll down through Mark Thornton's speeches and such, and look for his one on the gold standard. And you get a very clear, easy to understand, sound economic explanation of the gold standard. What do I think Stockman is hoping to achieve? I think he's hoping to convince people that the government has corrupted capitalism and has adopted this system of economic fascism that is the source of the problem, the crash, and the bailout, and the tremendous debt. And he has relatively young children for a 66-year-old man, and I think he's generally worried about them not having a future in this country. And so I really think that's what motivated Stockman. Glass-Steagall, Alan's asking about Glass-Steagall. They unseparated commercial banks from the banks, but I think it had nothing to do with the crash because it didn't really have any time to have any significant effect on the stock market or the economy as a whole after they did that. This is a classic case of the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. The Congress deregulated parts of Glass-Steagall. A depression occurred, therefore Congress's partial deregulation of Glass-Steagall caused a depression. I don't buy it. That's not what happened. If you look closely into it, that's not what happened. So reinstating it is not a good idea. What would the U.S. look like if we weren't an imperialist power? It would look like Switzerland, I would think. They don't have a worldwide army in 150 countries to pay taxes for in Switzerland. Okay, we might be running out of gas here. If you don't want to know the next class I'm going to teach, I haven't decided that yet. It's been more than a year since I taught my class called Freedom and Federalism, the Classical Liberal States' Rights Tradition. I've also been thinking of a class on myths and lies about markets and government. And there's a lot that can be said about that, but it would be based on economic research that I've done and published and others have done and published on this topic of mischaracterizing markets and governments in some big ways, like antitrust policy, banking policy, and natural monopoly, and all sorts of subjects that we economists talk about. I do have a course on the political economy of war, but I just taught it less than a year ago, so I'm not sure. I did do a class on Lincoln several months ago. Okay. let's see, Leslie is asking why Lehman Brothers is allowed to think and AIG saved. Well, I haven't done the research on them that Rothbard did on the Morgans and the Rockefellers. But if I were to start doing research, I would start off with the assumption that companies like AIG were much, much better at lobbying and giving campaign contributions to the Washington establishment than Lehman Brothers was. Just as when the government went after Microsoft, 15, 20 years ago now, Microsoft was famous for not even having a lobbying office in Washington, D.C. And the government made them pay a price and taught them a lesson that if you don't play the game like this, you don't become a billionaire in America, Bill Gates, and not giving us our take, us politicians our take. In that sense, they're just like the mafia that says if you want to do business in this neighborhood, you have to give us a percentage or else we'll break your kneecaps. Minus the threat of breaking Bill Gates' kneecaps, the government said the same thing. If you want to do business in this country, you've got to give us our take and open up that lobbying office in Washington, D.C. and start sending us money. And so even mighty Microsoft, a company that big, they were the target of a 10-year-long investigation and then a lawsuit instigated by their competitors who were politically connected. And so, I haven't researched specifically AIG and Lehman, but that's probably what happened, is that they let their guard down a little bit, didn't pay a big enough tribute to Washington, D.C., and it cost them. That's how the game is played. Helen wants to know what percentage of the defense budget goes to corporations. Almost all of it, I would think. Minus the salaries of the soldiers, it all goes to corporations who provide all the goods and products and bombs and airplanes and bullets to the military. Who's running the Rockefeller and Morgan empires? I'm not sure. Probably not one person. Okay. Well, I guess we're kind of running out of gas here then. Okay, maybe we'll wrap it up then. It seems to be running out of gas. And so thank you all for participating. And I hope you learned a lot. And I hope you keep learning. And feel free to recommend other courses. Some of you already have. And I'll take them into consideration and see what I can do in putting them together. And keep taking these courses and educating people around you. And have a good night, and I'll make up that exam.